Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 13th of May 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's episode is number 37, and once again we are concentrating on the early history of Great Britain, and I guess the extended Britannic Isles. And of course, today I have with me my co-host, the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Patriarch, how are you doing? How's life treating you?
I'm very well, thanks. Life's pretty good. Just waiting for summer to kick in and enjoying the spring weather, actually. Really, it's one of my favourite times of year. Me and the wife go for a lot of walks around nearby. We live on kind of the edge of this village, and we are overlooking some kind of hills and fields and forestation, and there's just so many places to walk and discover. It's really nice. So just enjoying, the weather, really.
You really can't beat village life, and also Britain, as the seasons change, and if you're just in one place, you get used to seeing what the vegetation is like at different times of year and start seeing the animals and the fields. Yeah,
it's lovely. We could take the same route, and every week or so you notice changes and you go through all the seasons, and so it's nice.
Get plenty of free food as well in the really rural areas. Get the hazelnuts and blackberries in the hedgerows and all sorts like that.
Last summer there was quite a lot of berries, different types of berries growing, so made use of them.
And all our ancestors, they didn't used to have to go to the shop to pay for their food. They would harvest their food, and they were very tuned in with the times of year, and they would have their festivals at the solstice and the equinox, and it would all be officiated over by the Druids. And we're going to be talking some more about the Druids this week. It's going to be the second part in a little mini section here on the Druidic religion of Britain. And once again, we're going to be quoting from R.W. Morgan, but from a different book this time. He also wrote a book called St. Paul in Britain in 1860, and a third of the book is just about Druidry. And some of it is repeated in the history of the Cambrians, which is what we've been looking at. And I've basically cut out the bits that we've already covered, and I've got some of the new bits here that I'd like to get into this week. And then if we've got time, we'll also look at Wilson and Blackett talking about the way that Druidry has continued. And if we still have time at the end, I've got some more by E. Raymond Capt, looking at the links between Druidry and the ancient Israelite religion. But we'll start with R.W. Morgan's St. Paul in Britain, and this is what he has to say about the origins of Druidry. Westwards of Italy, embracing Hispania, Gallia, the Rhenish frontiers, portions of Germany and Scandinavia, with its headquarters and great seats of learning fixed in Britain, extended the Druidic religion. There can be no question that this was the primitive religion of mankind, covering at one point in various forms the whole surface of the ancient world. The ramifications of Druidism penetrated, indeed, into Italy, Greece, and Asia Minor. Nor did Plato hesitate to affirm that all the streams of Greek philosophy were to be traced not to Egypt, but to the fountains of the West. The prehistoric poets of Greece, anterior to the mythological creations of Homer and Hesiod, were, as their names imply, Druids. Musasus, Orpheus, Linus, which means knowledge, the harp, and the white-robed. Such historians were necessarily poets, for with the Druids, metre was the vehicle of instruction. The visit of the British Druid Abaris was long remembered at Athens. Greek fancy converted the magnetic needle by which he guided his travels into an arrow of Apollo, which would transport him at wish whithersoever he pleased. A more celebrated Druid, Pythagoras, founded a school in Italy, the effects of which, though he himself and many of his leading scholars perished in a popular commotion, were never wholly obliterated. The transmigration of souls, their pre-existence and immortality, the true theories of the heavenly bodies and their revolutions, the severity of the esoteric system with its silence and secrecy being observed by various Italian sects right down to the Christian era. So we've got two points that I want to pick up on here. And the first one is where he says that metre was the vehicle of instruction. And that's because they remembered things mnemonically. That you would have like a rhyme to whatever it was that they were learning, and that would help them to remember it. So this is why that so much of what we had in the past was written in poetry, was so that it could be remembered without having to be written down. And the other bit I wanted to concentrate on was just this bit about Abaris. But do you have a comment on the poetry there, Patriarch?
It makes sense, you know, to have alliteration and, you know, kind of, you know, rhyming couplets. And I'm assuming that that kind of has a bit more of a punch and rhythm to it, so it's easier to remember, because it's kind of cued recoil, isn't it, for the memory when you have similar sounding words, and it flows easier as opposed to large chunks of text.
Yeah, much as I dislike rap music, I guess that was, you know, the origin of it.
Yeah, well, I guess so. I mean, you've got classic, you know, the British poets such as William Blake. I mean, and he was renowned for rhyming couplets. I used to write a lot of poetry myself, actually. And, you know, I really enjoy it, you know, the kind of the rhythm and the pacing of text. And I actually find most rap really quite novice compared to, you know, a lot of the word plays and poetry that our ancestors created.
Well, I also think the bards were part of the triple aspect of the Druids. You had the Druids, the bards and the Ovates, and the bards were the ones that really excelled at the musical, poetical side of it. And this other bit about Abaris, this shows the way that legends appear, and they talk about things which appear to be fanciful, like he supposedly could transport himself at wish with an arrow of Apollo. But what that was really talking about was the magnetic needle on a compass. So he knew exactly where he was, and he could navigate to wherever he was going to. So they obviously knew about magnetic north, and they knew about compasses. All the way back there at this time, which is, I don't know, 2,500 years ago, well, I should guess.
Yeah.
I could guess.
And, well, they wouldn't have called it a compass then.
No. Well, yeah, Arrow of Apollo. And also, I mean, the number of places that actually followed Druidry. And he thinks that this religion covered the whole surface of the known world, basically. This was the ancient religion. And all the other religions of the time, Hinduism, Buddhism, he thinks they all have similarities to Druidry, because that's originally where they came from.
And well, I guess it would kind of make sense if one thing we're going to touch on later, as you mentioned earlier, that there's links between the Druids and you know, ancient Israel and the essentially the foundations of the Bible. So, you know, it's essentially linking the two, isn't it? Or obviously Druidism would have kind of been an offshoot of you know, the biblical traditions.
Well, I think what he's referring to is the religion that the Adamites had before Abraham, the religion that Seth had, the religion that Noah had, and the priestly religion that they actually had before it all became formalized. I think what he's really referring to is that Druidry was probably the closest to it, and where this religion evolved in the East, in the West, it remained how it was. That seems to be what the author's idea of it is.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, but I'm not sure where that fits biblically. I'd have to look into that.
Well, have a look for his evidence for this, which we'll get into now. In the Aegean Sea, Samothrace and Delos were eastern cells of the same priesthood, the same rites being observed as in Britain, and embassies at stated periods exchanging visitations. In earlier ages, the city of Circles in Asia Minor, Troy, and the Minoan Labyrinth in Crete were seats of the same widely extended religion. And in Egypt, the name of the great mother temple, Karnak, identifies its remote founders with those of the mother temple of the exact same name in Brittany, both meaning the high stones of worship. So you're talking about Troy and labyrinth that we find in Troy. And when we were talking about that, we also talked about the labyrinth that's found in Rocky Valley, on the wall in Rocky Valley in Cornwall, which is exactly mm-hmm. the same symbol that they had in Troy, same symbol that they had in Crete. So I guess he's linking the use of the same symbols as meaning that it was the same philosophy that they had. And this, I mean, to have the same name in Egypt as the temple that's in Brittany, that shows you that they were linked up, really, doesn't it? Because it means the same thing, the high stones of worship.
Yeah.
In the East, however, the principles of Druidism could only be traced in its earliest records, whilst on the continent of Europe, they bore in practice and development the same corrupt relation to primitive Druidism as at present the Roman Catholic religion in the same countries does to primitive Christianity. In Britain, on the contrary, it had, for many reasons such as the inaccessibility of the island, its freedom from foreign invasion, its character of sanctity, and its possession by the Gomeridae, retained in great degree its original purity. And again, we can see there the tastes of the author himself. He obviously had a bit of a dislike for Roman Catholicism. And you can also see here, but at this time, as I pointed out before, they believed that the people that peopled Britain were descended from Japhet, from the guy called Gomer, because they knew that the name was Cymri. They knew that the Cymrians, they could work that out. And they thought this word Cymrians and Cymri must go back to Gomer. But in actual fact, it doesn't. It goes back to Cymri, the king of Israel. And that's the name that the Assyrians referred to the Israelites by. And the same word was Scusa, which is where we get Scythian from, and also Habiru. So it was mm-hmm. after this book had actually been written that they discovered this. I don't think it was until the 1930s, 1940s, when they found the Assyrian tablets that confirmed all of this. Because obviously they found the Behistun rock, but if you just got the rock which says that, you need to have more evidence than just that. And they found all these tablets in a library at Nineveh, which confirmed that that's what the name of this people were. They were referred to as the Cymri, and they were living in the exact area that the Bible tells us that the Israelites were removed to. So that's why he thinks it's Gomeridae.
I mean, the fact that the new information is constantly emerging and the kind of resurgence of history, it would have to force you to reevaluate specific doctrines that you hold when it comes to understanding the Bible, because if 500 years ago it's kind of like forgotten knowledge, then obviously the doctrines have been steered down a certain path, and with the emergence of this new information, it only makes sense to try and reassess the doctrines at hand that have kind of been shaped.
That's it. If you're a genuine seeker of your truth, then you have to adapt to the information that comes your way. And that's the criticism that I would have of British Israel, because they've ignored all the findings that have been made since British Israel first started. And Christian identity sort of branched out from British Israel, and it continued to adapt in response to new discoveries, new translations, whereas British Israel just sort of remained the same. People do get frightened to take on new knowledge, especially if it challenges their beliefs or says that your beliefs should change in some way. A lot of people mm-hmm. don't have the courage to do that, and they'd rather not find this information out. But I would rather know the information and have my beliefs as close to the truth as it's possible to get. Even if it does hurt, the truth is supposed to hurt, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But I think for some, belief system is often linked with like a comfort system as well, a comfort blanket. So, once they've built a certain framework of belief and understanding around a set doctrine, it's kind of not necessarily the core of the meaning behind the belief, but the belief itself that people become dependent on, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like blind faith, and that almost becomes a virtue in some cases, and they might think that they're being tested by this new information and they should ignore it. You know, we have the powers of logic and deduction. They were given to us so that we might know God, basically. I mean, that's how you come to the realization that there is a God and there is a creator. It comes from looking at the world logically. I mean, faith isn't, it shouldn't be blind faith. It's faith is a belief that a promise is going to be kept. It's not a belief in something for which there is no evidence for, which is the modern interpretation. It's a confidence that a promise is going to be kept. So you have confidence that God exists from looking at the world around you. And that's why we have these powers of reason, so that we can reason things out and we can use our logic. And from that, we can make the deduction that, yes, clearly there is a God. Clearly there is a way that we should be living. And we've gone off course. But it's all to do with your powers of reason, or it should be. It shouldn't just be because somebody told you to believe this. And that's what I think a lot of the antichrists, they make their criticism of, oh, people are just believing what they've been told. And what they really mean is that they don't actually understand it themselves. That's what it really boils down to. Well, in the time of St. Paul, it had been for a period of 2,000 years the established religion. So for the same amount of time that Christianity has been the religion, Druidry was the established religion. And the attachment of the people to its rule, with the desperate and well-sustained defence they made on its behalf and that of their country against the whole force of the Roman Empire in the meridian of its power, confirm the impression left by a dispassionate examination of the remains of its theology, which have descended to us in the ancient British tongue, namely that it was a highly moral, elevating, and beneficent religion, a superstructure not unworthy of the principle on which it assumed to be built and by which it offered itself to be judged, the truth against the world. And that was the motto of Druidry, basically, the truth against the world. I mean, it sounds as if it could be something that was taken from the Bible, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
The truth will set you free. And he also points out here that the British people defeated the Roman Empire when it was right at the apex of its power. The British people defeated the Roman Empire, and they credited their religion as being a lot of the reason for that, because they believed in the immortality of the soul. If they died in battle, they would live on in heaven and come back again to earth because they believed in this reincarnation. And
sounds like a mix of things.
Yeah.
Almost, you've got the kind of Valhalla type belief, which obviously made them kind of fearless, brutal warriors. I mean, to have that belief that, you know, you're going to be dining in Valhalla as soon as you get an axe in your head, is like they feel like they're basically charging their way into paradise.
Well, the Druids believed they would come back here. They believed if they died, they would have reincarnation. So it didn't matter if they died. They had no fear of death. That's what Caesar said. They had no fear of death, and they would even arrange to pay debts after they had come back, basically. And this reincarnation belief, I mean, this was in the ancient world, but it was strongly here in Britain. It has been observed by the historian Hume that no religion has ever swayed the minds of men like the Druidic. The determined efforts of the Roman Empire to overthrow its supremacy, and if possible suppress it altogether, prove that its rulers had been made practically aware of this fact. A Druidic triad familiar to the Greeks and Romans was, there are three duties of every man: worship God, be just to all men, die for your country. It was this last duty, impressed by a thousand examples and precepts, and not its religious tenets or philosophy, which caused Druidism to be marked out for destruction by an empire which aspired to universal dominion and to merge all nationalities into one city. So saying Rome was globalist, basically. It was the globalist structure of its day, and the Druids were against it because they identified with their people and they identified with their country. And I just wanted to point out also those triads. I mean, they're, again, going back to this using verse to remember things, if you remember that there are three things connected together, it's going to make it easier to remember. And all our laws apparently used to be in that form. That's why they're called triads, the three things. Right. And that was how they remembered it.
Yeah, and we made the point last week, didn't we, about that kind of number three common thread, the Trinity and just the Godhead, and three being a very significant number. It's a very significant number in nature in general, number three.
Yeah, well, definitely. You have one single on it on its own, two together, and then three, and then you can make the triangle from it. And those three points, that triangle, you can then make just about every other structure that there is in the world from those three points, can't you?
Mm-hmm.
And you've got past, present, and future. Got three dimensions to everything.
So that was interesting, the point that I made about Rome wanting to be, you know, what, essentially globalist and almost creating the modern version at the time of, I guess, Babylon.
Yeah.
You know? But I wonder, would they be all sort of Adamic white nations?
They were originally, but I think then later on to the end, that's what caused Rome to fall apart, really, wasn't it? It was sort of allowing people in from everywhere.
Right.
They could become citizens.
Yeah. Maybe for the same reasons, you know, when it comes to needing to prop up the you know, the empire, you have to start looking at people that are willing to kind of work for less and you know, just to embrace anyone that will help to prop up the system, and kind of not understanding that it's the people that made an integral part of the empire in the first place.
Well, this is why the Germanic tribes were able to take Rome. I mean, they weren't civilized. They didn't have the arts of civilization, but they still had the ethnic solidarity and the strong morality, and they were able to take Rome. And I did read some quotes a while back. I'm trying to remember the name of the book. And that was talking about these Germanic tribes when they went to North Africa, and they were shocked by the licentiousness, and they outlawed prostitution because there was just open fornication that was going on, and that's what actually led to the downfall of that part of the Roman Empire. And it was taken over by the Vandals, and that king, that Vandal king, then later on came to Britain, and he's referred to as the King of Africa. And yeah, they took over Rome that the Saxons did, and the Germanic tribes. And that was the reason why, because Rome had become decadent and it had become multicultural by that time. It's the same as Babylon, the same as the EU today. I mean, we tend to look up to Rome because it was so formidable in battle, but it's the same thing as NATO today, isn't it? NATO is formidable in battle, but you wouldn't think that NATO was a good thing, looking at it.
Mm.
Well, the edicts of the emperors Augustus and Tiberius proscribed it throughout their dominions, making the exercise of the functions of a Druidic priest as those of the Roman priest in the reigns of the Tudor sovereigns in England a treasonable offence. But nations cannot be proscribed. The Druidic colleges in Britain, the only free state in Europe at this period, continued to educate and send forth their alumni to all parts of the continent. Not until AD 43, that is 14 years only before the arrival of St. Paul in Rome, did the second or Claudian invasion of Britain take place. It took 10 years of incessant warfare to establish a firm footing in the south of the island, nor was it until 7 years after the fall of Caractacus that the Roman state ventured to give its legions orders to carry out the leading object of the invasion, the destruction by force of arms of the Druidic curiae or seminaries in Britain. The Boadicean War and the death of 80,000 Roman citizens were the first results of this policy of religious dragonades. So again, that's an interesting bit of history that most people aren't aware of, is just how long it took the Romans to actually pacify Britain. I mean, 24 years it looks like it took here. I mean, how many people are aware that Druidism was also outlawed? I mean, everybody knows that Christianity was banned in Rome, but they also banned Druidism. And yet you had all the nobles from Gaul were coming to Britain to be educated in Druidry, and then they would be going back out into Europe, which was conquered by Rome at this time.
Mm.
And also where he says nations cannot be proscribed. So he obviously understands nation as the ethnic nation, not the civic nation. And this was only, 1860 that this was written. Well, Druidism was founded by Gwydion Ganebon, supposed to be the Seth of the Mosaic genealogy in Asia, in the year when the equinox occurred in the first point of Taurus, or the constellation of the bull. Now, I'm not sure where they get the name from, Gwydion Ganebon. That would probably be Welsh histories, Welsh legend. But a lot of people claim Seth to be the originator. I think in Egypt, they claim that Seth was the originator of writing as well. And they linked him in with Hermes Trismegistus. And Enoch also gets linked in as well. They say that there are similarities between these ancient originators of these philosophical beliefs, and the symbols that they used were the same symbols that Seth used or Enoch used. So I don't know how much truth we can credit that with.
I wonder if the bull and the age of Taurus had anything to do with the bull that the Israelites were said to be worshipping when Moses came down from the mountain Sinai.
Well, that's what R.W. Morgan thinks. It's actually very interesting, this bull symbol. Every year, the equinoctial year is completed about 20 minutes before the sun has made a complete revolution from a certain star to the same star again. This arises from the precession of the equinoxes, or from a slow revolution of the pole of the equator around that of the ecliptic. In 25,920 years, the pole of the equator makes one entire revolution around that of the ecliptic. Hence, the equinoctial colure occurs before it did the preceding year. In 72 years, the precession amounts to 1 degree. If, therefore, we have the equinoctial or solstitial point given in the ecliptic at any unknown period, it is easy to discover, by comparing it with the present solstitial point, how long that period is past. When the Druidic system was founded, the equinox on the 1st of May occurred in the first point of Taurus, which point is now, on the 1st of May, 80 degrees from this solstitial point. It requires 72 years to recede 1 degree. 80 degrees multiplied by 72 gives 5,760, which is the exact date when Druidism commenced, i.e. 3,903 years before the Christian era, 181 years after the creation of Adam, and 50 years after the birth of Seth. And clearly he's going on Usher's chronology there, working back the years of when Adam was created. But if you can work out the which part of the horoscope or which part of the skies you could see at the time when something started, today you can work out exactly when it began. So they've obviously got records that claim that it was begun when the equinox occurred in the first point of Taurus. So that shows we knew all about astronomy way back then. We had this knowledge.
Yeah. I've also looked in the past. There is somewhat of a correlation in some ways with the zodiacs, and if you think back to the bull, which you say is synonymous with the druids, straight after that you have the age of Aries, which is associated with the ram, and to some extent you could argue that that has something to do with the sacrifice and the age of kind of Abraham. And then you have Pisces, which is the fish, which was, some attest to the kind of age of Christ. And in modern day, now 2,000 years later, we're moving into the Aquarius with the water bearer. And that's kind of like the age of information. So, I'm not kind of married to that idea, but there's some interesting thoughts there.
Well, it fits in, doesn't it? I mean, it fits in with what we learned about Amun-Ra, the Egyptian god, which was the ram-headed god. And we tied that in with Abraham and his sacrifice of Isaac, and the ram that was put forward in the thicket, and the ram that was found in the royal tombs at Ur. It was obviously an important thing. And then you've got this Amun-Ra, which is the ram-headed god. And then, as you say, then you've got Christ as a sacrifice, and then Pisces with the fish. And the fish symbol of Christianity. So, yeah, I mean, it does all tie in. And the bull would have been the first one. And as you were pointing out earlier, there is this link with the bull, with the Old Testament and the Israelites, which he points out here. He says, the astral bull of milk-white hue, its horns crowned with golden stars, became the symbol or visible sacrament of Druidism. In process of time, the symbol, as usual, superseded in the East the thing signified, and Druidism became that Tauric religion which gave the Crimea the appellation of the Tauric Chersonese. Extending thence, this corruption became the religion of Mithras in Persia, of Baal in Assyria, of Brahma in India, of Ashtart or the Dei Assyria in Syria, of Apis in Egypt, and in later years transferred from Egypt of the two Apis, or two calves, as they are rendered in our version of the scriptures, of the kingdom of Israel. In all these religions, the bull, or Taurus, was the sacred animal, and the symbol was preserved free, as far as we can judge, from idolatry by the Gomeridae of Britain. The bull was the sign and representant of the great Druidic isle, and the name, still in common parlance, continues to indicate a Briton of Britain, as distinguished from the rest of the world. And of course, we also have the mascot, John Bull, the mascot of Britain, which that was like a sort of cartoon figure, John Bull, and as the equivalent of Uncle Sam, but for Britain from about the 1800s, I think.
Okay.
So it's interesting that that this symbolism goes all the way back to the start of Druidism, and that's where John Bull originally comes from. Brahma in India, yeah, that's one of his symbols is the bull, and you've got the sacred cow in India as well, and then you've got the golden calves in Israel. So you've got a link there between them all, and he says that this is what the link was. It was Druidry. This was the original religion.
Yeah, and it might have taken on slightly different forms, due to cultural differences, various parts of the world. Obviously, different cultures have different sort of expressions and tendencies, and the way they would approach things, and over time it'd be slight deviations, wouldn't there?
Yeah, and you've got Mithras slaying the bull as well. It's an important one. And over time, I mean, he's saying like 2,000 years, so you would sort of forget what the original reason was, why you were using the bull in the first place. And it would evolve. Mm-hmm. From Asia, Druidism was brought into Britain by Hugadan, or the Mighty, its first colonizer, a contemporary of the patriarch Abraham. And under his successors, Plenith, Goron, Alawan, and Rivon, it assumed its complete organization, becoming both the ecclesiastical and civil constitution of the island. And this Hugadan is a legendary character, but I can't find any evidence other than just these Welsh legends of Hugadan bringing it over. I mean, when you look at the Albion legend, there are links to things that were actually happening in Syria. When you look at the Brutus legend, you find there is evidence for that. But for Hugadan, it's just that's who they say it was that brought Druidry over here. And I can't find much other evidence than that. About 5 centuries before the Christian era, its civil laws were codified by Donald Malmud, who we covered a couple of weeks back, the British Numa, and have since that period remained the common, unwritten, or native laws of the island, as distinguished from the Roman, the Canon, and other codes of foreign introduction. These British or Druidic laws have been always justly regarded as the foundation and bulwark of British liberties. The examination of them does not fall within our present purpose. And of course, you got Alfred the Great referring to these laws that we actually had in Britain before he was here and before he codified everything. And this is why our laws in Britain are slightly different to the ones on the continent, which all came from Roman law. We had separate law here. And the fact that our separate law continued shows that when we made peace with Rome, we continued to keep our own laws. It wasn't like we were conquered by them and occupied by them. There was a treaty with them, and we kept our laws and we kept our sovereigns.
Yeah, I guess that would have been like the Jews in at the time the Judahites should I say, in the time of Judah, whilst living within the Roman Empire.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was the way that things were done back then. And you would have had your own quarter. And there was a British quarter within Rome. And the same today is when you have embassies. You know, in the city of London, there are various embassies. And in the embassies, or the diplomats there, cannot be held under the laws of the country, or they're exempt from the laws of the country. That's a very, very ancient law that goes back thousands of years, and that they refer to here, really, about the ambassadors when we were talking about the laws the other week. And a civil code and the sciences were taught by the Druids, orally or in writing indifferently, to every citizen. But the Druidic system of divinity was never committed to writing, nor imparted except to the initiated, and then under obligations to secrecy of a very awful character. It is, however, to the infraction of these obligations, when their force has been impaired by the influences of Christianity, that we are indebted for such knowledge as we do possess of the real principles of the primitive religion of our island. So he's saying that when the Druids became Christian, they wrote down some of these religious characters of what the ancient religion was, and we are to be thankful to them for the information that they left us. Druidism taught as follows: the universe is infinite, being the body of the being who out of himself evolved or created it, and now pervades and rules it as the mind of man does his body. The essence of this being is pure mental light, and therefore he is called Diu, the one without any darkness. His real name is an ineffable mystery, and so also is his nature. To the human mind, though not in himself, he necessarily represents a triple aspect in relation to the past, the present, and the future. The creator as to the past, the saviour or conserver as to the present, and the renovator or recreator as to the future. In the recreator, the idea of the destroyer was also involved. This was the Druidic Trinity, the three aspects of which were known as Beli, Taran, Isu, or Yisu. When Christianity preached Jesus as God, it preached the most familiar name of its own deity to Druidism. And in the ancient British tongue, Jesus has never assumed its Greek, Latin, or Hebrew form, but remains the pure Druidic Yisu. It is singular, thus, that the ancient Briton has never changed the name of the god that he and his forefathers worshipped, nor has he ever worshipped but one god. So that's another interesting fact. It was the same name that Jesus had, the god had that we used to worship, that the Druids worshipped, that we worship.
Really?
Yeah. In the aspect of the recreator, Yisu.
Is that just a massive coincidence, or?
Well, it could be. It could just be the way that, because Druidry was so influential in early Christianity, when they decided upon a Latinized name, that was the one that they used. It probably had an influence on the choice, I should imagine.
Yeah, but you know, the name would have been regional to, you know, to kind of the Hebrew language. So I don't see.
But it was Yeshua, wasn't it? Yeshua.
Yes, Yeshua. Yeah, and I mean, Joshua and Jesus are pretty much the same name, actually, aren't they? If you take the Hebrew, Joshua is the English form, I think.
And that's what you have here is Yeshu. So Yehoshua,
yeah.
Yeshu. And if you when you're yeah. talking just the main letters, Y, S, U, isn't it? Yeshu. And it's the same as the Druidic version.
So essentially the Druids pretty much worshipped Jesus and Yesu, sorry. But yeah, and Yesu was what the when you say deity, is that
the recreator.
The recreator, or would they don't see it as an incarnation of the god that they worship, no, or just the recreator?
Well, I mean, the idea is that Jesus is God himself, isn't it? So
from a Christian understanding, but I'm trying to understand what they thought of as Yeshu from their perspective.
Well, I should imagine they'd thought that this was Yeshu, the creator, the recreator, in man, that lived as man. It took on the form of a man, basically, which solved all these philosophical problems, didn't it? That if you listen to E. Michael Jones, he talks about that a lot, about how Christ incarnating in man solved the philosophical deadlock that the Greeks had come to with their philosophy.
But did this belief of Yeshu exist before Christ himself?
Well, the Druids obviously believed in him. I'm not sure if they were waiting for Messiah, but they understood that was the name of God, was Yeshu.
Okay. So, I mean, it's either a massive kind of coincidence or kind of divine type, a divine coincidence, or there might have been some influence, if I'm to speak from someone outside of if I was a Christian skeptic, I would argue, did, you know, beliefs such as Druidism influence Christian thinking and you know, doctrines and narratives?
I would say definitely, yeah. I definitely think it did. Early Christianity, definitely. The like the dogma and the ceremonies and the places, the holy places, the first places that were made into churches, they're the same places that the Druids used, basically. So it obviously had an influence on it. And I think the Trinity,
I understand that. I guess I'm just trying to think how far with how you say how far Druidry goes back, even before kind of Abrahamic and kind of Moses and the collation of, you know, that the belief set of that faith, the Abrahamic religion and the Ten Commandments and everything and all the prophecies of the books, which speak about, you know, Messiah and whatnot. All I'm saying is if Druidism came out of, you know, biblical influence, then I could understand the link. But if Druidism precedes that, then you have to argue that, you know, Christianity and the other faiths were kind of shaped around Druidism.
Well, I think Druidism continued to evolve, and we had more and more migrations coming in from the east. And I dare say that Druidry itself would have had prophecies that tied in with Christianity as well, because there was no animosity between the two, and the Druids became Christians. The Archflamens became archbishops, and Christianity took off in Britain pretty much before any other country, I think. Mm. Well, yeah, it was before any other country. It was the first country to proclaim itself Christian. So there was no animosity there. So the Druids obviously had an understanding of what they were being told. And we'll get to that as well later on. I mean, there are quotes that say that it was a new thing in Asia, but it wasn't new in Britain. So they must have had an understanding of it, and they must have had prophecies that were fulfilled in Christ, and not just, you know, the same name for God as the name of Christ, or the name that Christ took. The symbol of the ineffable name of the deity was three rays or glories of light. Every druid bore these in gold on the front of his mitre. Other names of the deity were Dion, Dovith, Kelly, Tor, Perith, Sol, Hrun, and Nur. In the infinite deity exists in some incomprehensible mode, indivisible from himself, infinite germs, seeds, or atoms, each in itself full and perfect deity, possessing the power of infinite creativeness. This branch of Druidic theism is involved in profound obscurity. It appears to have supplied Democritus with his theory of the atomic powers of nature, and Plato with his typal forms in the mind of the deity. So we're talking about their idea of matter here, and how it could be broken down into tiny atoms, basically. Before we had the theory of the atom, and before Democritus had it, the Druids had an understanding of this. Matter was created and systematized simultaneously by the Creator pronouncing his own name. It cannot exist without God. Nature is the action of God through the medium of matter. The laws of nature are, in the strictest sense, the laws of God. And that which is a violation of the laws of nature is necessarily a violation of the laws of God. The universe is in substance eternal and imperishable, but in form it is subject to successive cycles of dissolution and renovation. There is no such thing as annihilation in matter. Every particle of matter is capable of all forms of matter, and each form has its own laws of existence and action. And again, that's true, isn't it? You can break everything down. I like this, that the laws of nature are the laws of God, basically. God was the designer of the laws of nature. So if you're violating the laws of nature, you're violating the laws of God.
Yeah, I really kind of can get on board with that. It's in some ways, when I was I was raised Christian, Catholic, and then kind of Pentecostal Christian, and I have to question a lot of things, and you know, kind of the JQ and stuff came away, and I went into an agnostic kind of state, and making these connections myself, and you know, questions about the universe and God and how, you know, the different nature of God, and then obviously coming back to Christianity, marrying the two. So this for me kind of really fits together well.
Well, if you want to learn more about it, if listeners want to learn more about it, you can find the download of St. Paul in Britain. You can find it at the Christian Identity Forum Library. And he does go into a lot of detail on the theology of the Druids. I left it out because it's very complex. But yeah, if people want to have a look at that, it is available online. You can also purchase the book itself from Covenant Publishing, which is the British company that produce British Israel and Christian Identity books. So you can get it there. It's R.W. Morgan, St. Paul in Britain. And as I say, I left out the bit that went deeply into the theology, and next we move into the university cities. The lapse of 2,000 years has made but slight alteration in the names of the primitive cities of Britain. The Romans invariably fixed upon the chief car of a British tribe, generally the strongest military position in its bounds, for their castra. Hence the castra and chester superseded the car or British citadel. But the British name itself survived the Roman. So it's saying where you see chester anywhere in a British name, that's from Rome, and that basically replaced the car, which was the British word for a citadel. Like Carchemish, like you get in Syria, Carthage, like you get in North Africa, and then we have Carleon, Cardiff, and various other places. He says Lindane is still London, not Augusta. Werlen or Verulam, not Municipium. Carcol or Colchester, not Camulodunum. And there's a lot more there as well. The students at these universities numbered at times 60,000 souls, amongst whom were included the young nobility of Britain and Gaul. It required 20 years to master the circle of Druidic knowledge, nor, when we consider the great range of acquirements which the system included, can we wonder at the length of such probation. And that's because they studied natural philosophy, astronomy, arithmetic, geometry, jurisprudence, medicine, poetry, and oratory were all proposed and taught. And the first two, that's natural philosophy and astronomy, with severe exactitude. The system of astronomy inculcated had never varied, being the same as that taught by Pythagoras, now known as the Copernican or Newtonian. And the British words for star, astronomer, and astronomy are seven, Sereneth, and Serenedieth. Hence, the usual Greek term for the Druids was Serenidae, or astronomers. So the actual name they had for the Druids is linked with this, their knowledge of the stars, and then you tie that in with the positioning of all the megaliths and the stone circles. They're all linked up with the stars, basically. They're all pointing at star rises or moon rises, sun rises. They're great astronomical observatories, which shows that they had a lot of knowledge. That's what I was thinking earlier. I mean, where did they get this knowledge from? It had to have been given to them. It had to have been by divine revelation that they got the knowledge of the stars. They couldn't have just got it by trial and error, because you're talking 27,000 year cycles. It had to have been given to them by divine revelation, the same as so much that we see in the Bible came from divine revelation. And the Greek idea was philosophy. It was talk about things, but that could only get you so far. And that was the uniqueness of Christianity. It put the divine revelation of the Hebrews with the philosophy of the Greeks, and that's where Christianity came from.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about the beginning of civilization, and to understand these cycles, then what we're basically saying is that this level of information has to supersede time beyond recorded history and civilization, which would have been somewhat academic and have language and, you know, that kind of level of understanding. So there's a gap, basically. And so that gap must be filled by something outside of common man.
Definitely. I think, how else would they have had the knowledge to build those great civilizations? They had to have that knowledge there, had to have been given them. They couldn't have evolved over time. It's like you needed to know astronomy, navigation, before you could come to the countries of the north. You'd have to know how to do weaving and clothing. You'd have to know how to preserve food. You'd have to know all sorts of things before you could come to the north. And then you got writing as well. And when we looked at the first civilizations that came about around about 3000 BC at the start of the Bronze Age, they just suddenly explode forth with all this technology that they never had before. You know, and I think the only explanation for it has to be that it was through divine revelation that they got this stuff. And that's what the legends tell us. It says that the fallen angels taught the arts of civilization to man before he was ready for them. And that's, you know, the origin of the wars and the troubles that we've had. Getting back here to these quotes, "He that will be a prophet of God," writes Gildas, "must never rest till he has traced everything to its cause and mode of operation. He will then know what God does, for God does nothing but what should be in the manner it should be at the time and in the order it should be. By understanding these laws of God, he will be able to see and foretell the future." Principles of Prediction of Gildas the Prophet. And Gildas was a very famous British man who, again, gave some quotes about early Christianity that we'll come to later. "Prophecy, then, was with the Druids nothing but the theological term for science. And Gildas supplies a useful commentary on Caesar's words, which are these: the Druids discuss many things concerning the stars and their revolutions, the magnitude of the globe and its various divisions, the nature of the universe, and the energy and power of the immortal gods." And that's from Caesar's commentary. So he understood that these were very intelligent people that understood the way that the world worked. And from studying the way that the world worked and studying the laws of nature, the Druids were able to foretell the future, which I should imagine was foretelling eclipses, knowing how the skies are going to move, knowing what the time of year is, knowing exactly where they were from looking at the sky above, because they understood navigation. Very intelligent people, and they had to have been up to a certain standard of technology to have beaten the Romans, which they did, which the Britons did. "Of the attainments of the Druids in all the sciences, especially in this of astronomy, classic judges of eminence, Cicero and Caesar, Pliny and Tacitus, Diodorus Siculus and Strabo speak in high terms. In the Druidic order indeed centered, and from it radiated, the whole civil and ecclesiastical knowledge of the realm. They were its statesmen, legislators, priests, physicians, lawyers, teachers, poets, the depositaries of all human and divine knowledge, its church and parliaments, its courts of law, its colleges of physicians and surgeons, its magistrates, clergy, and bishops. The number of Druids was regulated by very stringent laws in proportion to the population. None could be a candidate for the order who could not, in the May Congress of the tribe, prove his descent from 9 successive generations of free forefathers." So again, lots of references here for how intelligent these Druids were and the system that they had. Cicero, Caesar, Pliny, Tacitus, Diodorus Siculus and Strabo, all speaking in the highest terms about the Druids. And what they're basically saying is a religion that permeated everything. So they were the scientists, they were the teachers, and at the same time, they were the priests. And that was every aspect of life was governed by the belief system of Druidry, which I guess is how Christianity was as well in its early years.
Yeah, I just wonder how far it actually spanned Druidism.
What, in time or geography?
Well, or both time and across different nations. It would be interesting to see visually the impact that it had.
Yeah. Well, you're saying here that it went all the way to Asia, basically.
From west to Asia.
Yeah, from east to west. And also, I mean, if you look at the earliest evidence that there is when they look into Egypt and what have you, they say that the earliest belief system was one God, which makes sense. You know, you've only got one father. And there was originally only one God. It was monotheism, and monotheism became corrupted into polytheism. So, and if they say, well, you can tie this back to that point in Taurus, which goes back to around about 4000 BC, that's just about the time of Adam, or just before Adam, around about the time of Adam. So it's saying that was the original religion, how it started off, and then it became corrupted over time. As everything does. Yeah. No slave, of course, could become a druid. He forfeited his order and privileges. And hence, perhaps one of the reasons of the protracted, stubborn, and finally successful resistance of the Druidic island to the Roman arms. For it was not until the reign of Adrian in AD 120 that Britain was incorporated, and then by treaty, not by conquest, with the Roman dominions, with the Britons retaining their kings, their land, their laws, and their rights, and stipulating in return to raise and support three legions to be officered by the emperor for the defence of the common empire. The accepting or circulating of Roman coin in Britain was made a capital offence by Arviragus, for such an act, according to the Roman construction, inferred the right of levying tribute, as we see in the scriptures. Whose image and superscription is this? Caesar's. Render therefore unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. From the reign of Claudius to that of Hadrian, no coins, therefore, of the intervening Roman emperors have ever been found in Britain. From Hadrian onwards, there have been found a nearly complete series. So up until that point, we never paid taxes to them. We would not pay tribute to them. The proof of that is that you cannot find the Roman coins in Britain at that time. And Arviragus, I think that was more of a title rather than the actual king's name. But we'll get to that when we talk about him. By common law, every Briton was seized as his birthright of 5 acres, that's 10 English acres of land, in the Gwelly Cenedl, or the bed or hereditary county of his clan. If the clan land was exhausted, recourse was had to emigration or conquest, and for this purpose the superfluous population was drafted off as an army, or more generally as a colony, hence the mother tribe and daughter tribes of the same name which so frequently occur in Britain, Gaul, Germany, and Hibernia. In addition to these 5 acres, the Druid received 5 acres more and a certain fixed income from his tribe. The difficulty of admission into the order was on a par with its privileges. The head of the clan possessed a veto on every ordination, and every candidate was obliged to find 12 heads of families as sureties for his moral conduct and adequate maintenance. Nor could he be ordained until he had passed 3 examinations, 3 successive years before the Druidic College of the tribe. So all sorts of hoops that they had to jump through here. And it also, you know, it tells you that you were given land, but that was your birthright, was that you would be given 5 acres of land. And if there wasn't enough, then a certain number of the people from the tribe had to go off as a colony, had to go off and fight for someone, or they had to go out as a conquest.
I think that's pretty awesome, isn't it? Can you imagine a government today and a nation today which just kind of just valued you as as a member of the nation and the tribe so much that it is willing to invest land into you to give you a prospecting future. Obviously, it's on you to reap what you sow on that land, but still, nevertheless, you're giving kind of hope from the start, aren't you?
Yeah, and it's the law of nature that you're going to keep expanding. There isn't going to be enough land for you here. You have to move on somewhere else. And I mean, that's what the Saxons were doing when they came here. That's what the Normans were doing when they came here.
I wonder, I wonder if many ways why that, I mean, to say how extensive the influence of the Druidic teachings were then at that time and how prevalent they were amongst Europeans, maybe that kind of sheds some insight as to why we went to war with each other so much, because it was literally ingrained through us or in our belief system, not just genetics, but our very belief system.
Yeah, to go out and conquer the land that you needed. And it was the same people, all white brothers, all white men, but from these various different clans and tribes. One of the things that gets me is that, you know, people will say, oh, I'm pagan and I worship Thor and Odin and all of this. That was only here for a couple of hundred years. We had Druidry for thousands of years. The Saxons came in, I think, in the 5th century. And by the 7th century, or by the 8th century, Alfred the Great was Christian. I mean, and the whole of England was Christian. So you had Woden, Odin and Thor for about 300 years. And all you had was wooden sheds that they had their little idols in. And when they became Christian, they burned down the wooden sheds. But they never touched the old religious sites of the Britons, the Druidic sites. They left them alone. I mean, we still have a lot of those that are still untouched today, and we have churches that were built near to them. But people that are British that say, I worship Odin or what have you, well, that was only here for 300 years.
Yeah, I think that a lot of that's due to somewhat pop culture influence, and also it's kind of like the go-to thing when you reject Christianity, or I'd say the influence of Judaic Christianity and Christianity rejecting that, and then the kind of the next go-to thing are things that are prominent in our culture today, such as, you say, Odin, you know, that are kind of constantly churned out in films and movies and made to look cool.
Yeah, it appeals to people, doesn't it? And also the image of the Vikings and the Saxons, and this image, and we're not told about the Britons. You know, they pretend that they were just doing nothing, and they were doing nothing until the Romans taught them how to do things, which is nonsense. You know, they were equals to the Romans, and yet people don't know about it, and they have this fantasized history where we were worshipping Odin and Thor. But from what I've looked into, I mean, people like Odin and Thor were ancestors. They were deified kings. They were kings from Asia, basically, around the same area as Troy, Asia Minor. And there were kings there, and the kings became deified over time with like worship of your ancestors, honoring your ancestors.
These
barriers to promiscuous admission threw the order almost entirely into the hands of the Blanarion, or the aristocracy, making it literally a royal priesthood. Kings, princes, and nobles entering largely into its composition. All power, states Caesar, speaking of Gaul, is vested in the two orders of the Druids and the aristocracy. The people are nothing. This, however, was evidently not the case in Britain, where the primitive Druidic laws, unaffected hitherto by foreign innovations, referred the source of all power to the people in Congress, and every Congress was opened with the words, "The country is above the king," and they have that in Welsh here, I won't attempt to pronounce it. Nevertheless, the authority and influence of the Druids were very great, and on the whole as popular as they were great. The extreme penalty lodged in their hands, and the one most dreaded, was that of excommunication, pona gravissima, states Caesar, which was in fact a decree of expulsion from both worlds, the present and the future. The terror it inspired is the best proof that it was not abused and was but rarely resorted to, for the most terrific punishments, if abused, soon lose their effect and become despised. The Druidic was essentially a priesthood of peace. neither wearing arms nor permitting arms to be unsheathed in its presence. And though patriotism, or the defence of one's country in a just war, was a high virtue in its system, we have no instance of Druidism persecuting or using physical force against any other religion or set of opinions. Its whole theory, indeed, would have stultified itself in so doing, and herein consists no small part of its identity with Christianity. In the ancient world, observes Higgins in his book Celtic Researches, the Druids were the only priesthood of peace. Clad in his white canonicals, the Druidic herald presented himself between two armies, and every sword was instantly sheathed. The saying of Taliesin, the prince bard and druid, conveys a great historic truth, although over-strongly expressed. Christ, the word from the beginning, was from the beginning our teacher, and we never lost his teaching. Christianity was a new thing in Asia, but there never was a time when the Druids of Britain held not to its doctrines. And that's a very old quote there. And I guess that is referring to the Druids originally following Christ anyway. The word from the beginning was their teacher. So that's where this Yeshu, the name for God, came from. And they're saying they always followed that. And then they're saying that the doctrines of Christianity were a new thing in Asia, but they were pretty much exactly the same as the doctrines that the Druids already held in Britain. And that, yeah. I think that quote there is from probably about the 4th century. It's a really old quote. It's referred to a lot.
Taliesin. Yeah, I had a thought about the similarities between the names and the coincidence. And I was thinking, well, if it's the doctrine and understanding of the nature of God, then it would kind of make sense that the meaning of Christ, meaning God with us or anointed one, you know, kind of would go on to form a name, and as opposed to the name defining the kind of doctrine, if you know what I mean. So is that making sense?
Yeah,
so it's the sentiment of kind of, you know, God being with us, and then if they believe that God in the flesh, then to express that they have their version of the word, and then because their language wasn't so different from the general doctrine of God being with us through the flesh in Christ, Jesus, then, you know, that then that language is expressed, and obviously the similarities come about through the end result of the name.
Well, I think it's also referring to what Dr. E. Michael Jones does as well, the Logos, when it says Christ, the Word from the beginning. That's referring to the book of John, and that's referring to the Logos. So they understood that Christ was the Logos, Christ was the truth. As they say, he was from the beginning our teacher. That's what Logos is. It's the study of everything, which ties in with this belief of the Druids that you understood God by observing nature and observing the laws of nature. And that's where the whole of science comes from. This is what I mean. It's not blind faith. It's science. And today we've lost our way. We've gone against all of this and think that we know better when we don't. Well, I think we should probably leave that here this week, Patriarch. So I say thank you very much for coming on today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Been interesting today. Thanks.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.